Sam Wasson is an author and film critic whose most recent book is The Big Goodbye, Chinatown, and the Last Years of Hollywood. This is Sam Wasson. I'm Duncan Gammy. You're listening to Dunk Tech. All right. I'm here with Sam Wasson. Sir, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you, Duncan.
So I found you because of a great book that you wrote recently called The Big Goodbye and the Last Years of Hollywood. I don't know how much authors get to choose their titles, but why call it The Last Years of Hollywood?
Well, it brings up, I mean, what is Hollywood? You know, if you think Hollywood is just going to the movies, then you might quibble with that title, or you might reject that title. I mean, I think Hollywood is much richer cultural experience, much richer artistic experience, social and communal experience, and all of those things have virtually disappeared. So if you're new to this thing called Hollywood, you may think nothing's changed, but in fact, everything's changed. And I wanted to write a book explaining how that happened.
Okay, and the film that it centers around, Chinatown, then, would you say it's fair to say that this era that we're talking about in Hollywood history comes after sort of the studio system breaks down from the 40s and 50s, and then before there's this giant corporatization of Hollywood? Is that what we're talking about here?
Well, it's actually close. I mean, the corporatization happened around the time of the era that I'm celebrating. So corporatization was not the problem, because a lot of these, you know, when Warner Brothers was taken over and Columbia was taken over and Paramount were taken over, they hired the right people to run the studios. And the actual influx of corporate money helped to revitalize the studios. So it's not the corporate that's the evil, it's the way the corporate is arranged. And that started to go south in the years following Chinatown. So I look at this as a case study, this movie Chinatown, as a case study in how to make a movie during this era of filmmaking, and just about the last time that these kinds of movies were made regularly.
Okay. So, and on that note then, basically the way the four main characters, as I read the book, are, we can just go through them one by one, if you will. Roman Polanski, you got to talk to him, correct?
Yep.
Okay. And when he was making this movie, he was at a very weird place in his life. This was something like 4 years after Sharon Tate was murdered.
I think 4 years. Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah.
And you talk about how in the book, there's some psychiatrist tells him that he should be able to get over it after 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
He tells him at the time that his wife has been murdered. And then mm-hmm. 4 years has passed and he's still not over it.
That's right.
So how did that, the Manson murders, all that, influence what Polanski brought to this movie?
Well, I love that you mentioned the 4 years. I mean, that's so what this book is about, you know, the feeling of it never, you know, it doesn't end, the haunt of trauma, the wounds never totally heal. And that's part of what Chinatown is about. So yes, Roman was thinking about Sharon throughout the movie. Thinking about Los Angeles, naturally, a city that was haunted for him, quite obviously. So haunted, in fact, that he left town after the murders intended, and easy for him to come back to make this movie. So yes, his ghosts were all around. But that's part of what talent is, you know? That's part, talent is wrangling those ghosts, because those ghosts are who you are. You live with, we all live with our ghosts. And the closer we are to them, the deeper our work can be. And Roman, a man of many ghosts, is I think not surprisingly a man of unusual talent.
Yeah, and obviously, I mean, I do just want to mention that he's become a very controversial and sort of infamous character for now he can't come back in the country without being arrested and so on. But one of the things, speaking of ghosts, that you mentioned is he was in the Warsaw ghettos at one mm-hmm. point. Do you think that he would have made a substantially different movie if his wife hadn't been murdered, and because it seems like he had plenty of trauma in his life already.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I do. There's no way to prove that, obviously, because you're talking about alternate history. But I do believe he would have made a different movie. You know, I mean, these traumas define who we are, and seeing as that we are the ones making the movies, you know, if he's the one making the movie, then it follows that his trauma is the one making the movie. His trauma is plural. And that's not, you know, that goes for everyone. That's not specific to Roman. That's you and that's me and it's everyone.
Right. Yeah, fair enough. People are, you know, all their experiences. And
that's he, right, right.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't he the one that shifted this movie from having initially like a happy ending to what it eventually became?
Yes. Robert Towne, who's a writer of the script, wanted more of a bittersweet ending. And Roman wanted a total annihilation. And surely that comes from experiences like Sharon Tate and it also comes from his experiences as a moviegoer, being impressed by tragic endings, being changed by tragic endings. And of course, one could speculate that he was given to a connection to tragic endings because he understood tragedy. You know, all those pieces fit, and whether or not they're true, you know, it's certainly my responsibility as a biographer to say, here are the themes consistent with this man. And it was there for the, you know, I mean, so yes, I mean, he saw this as he sees everything, you know, through that lens of great tragedy and absurdity.
And one of the things that's so interesting about the making of this movie and why I thought this book was so good was because all of the main, these four driving characters behind the making of it had a mixed up past, like Jack Nicholson, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And you go into, at one point in the book, him and Polanski get into this terrific argument where Jack Nicholson is trying to catch the last minutes of some ball game on TV, mm-hmm, Polanski mm-hmm. adjusting the drapes. Or tell us what happened there, because it feels representative of a certain energy between them.
Well, Polanski needed Jack for the shot, basically, and Jack wanted to watch the ball game in the trailer, and an argument erupted that ended basically in Polanski throwing his hat at Jack and then Jack taking off his shirt and throwing his shirt at Polanski, Polanski taking off his pants, throwing them at Jack. And soon they're naked, throwing their clothes at each other, chasing each other out of the studio. And they sort of end in laughter and the sense of friendship and joy that was not atypical of this period in filmmaking. So that's what that story means to me, you know. This story to me is about a sense of fun and collaboration and ease that two people who have mutual respect for each other, you know, can so embrace at the end. That happens when people respect each other and want to be there and want to do what they're doing. And you don't find that so much today.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I mean, that's what it takes the whole book to sort of lay out. But really, the industry has become prohibitively risk averse, which is no atmosphere for freedom and creativity. How it became risk averse is the story that I told.
Right. And but even touching on that argument though, and you speak about the feeling of fun or mutual respect. It kind of sounds like two brothers sort of getting into an argument, because it is a certainly a close relationship. You wouldn't do that with a stranger, but that must have been bizarre for people on the set, no?
I think they thought it was hysterical. They thought it was hysterical. No, I don't think, I don't, I mean, of course, it's bizarre when people are throwing their clothes at each other.
Right.
But you know, these are creative people, and bizarre behavior is goes along with that. But no, I think the net effect was hilarity.
Okay. At this point, Jack Nicholson is, I think he's described, or if not literally, figuratively, as being sort of at the height of his powers. Is this Jack Nicholson at his best as an actor, you think?
You know, it's hard. I have other favorite Nicholson performances. This is not my favorite, but a lot of people would say it's their favorite Nicholson performance. It's certainly when he was introduced to the world as a leading man. So that in itself is a breakthrough. But height of his powers, you could make that argument, I think.
Okay. It seems like certain actors, and I don't necessarily want to put Nicholson in this category, but someone like Al Pacino, definitely when he's in a movie now, Al Pacino is playing, it feels like a version of himself. And Jack Nicholson, almost, at least the last few movies that he's done, I don't think he's done any recently, but it feels like he's playing Jack Nicholson. But that trend has not yet begun in this movie.
Great point. No, he's not the cartoon Jack Nicholson. He's not yet an idea of Jack Nicholson. That sort of starts to happen in the later 80s. And there is a function to th that that is also part of the story of the Hollywood decline. You can see it, you know, there's before Cuckoo's Nest and there's after Cuckoo's Nest in Jack's performances. And money has a lot to do with that. You know, they want that Jack thing. That's what they're paying for. That's what they get. That's what Jack delivers, with exceptions, of course, you know.
Right.
And it's not nothing. That Jack cartoon is still great, but it certainly doesn't give us the wide range of Nicholson that we had in the 70s.
And you mentioned the money aspect. At this point in the 70s, were actors' salaries at all, even adjusted for inflation, at all comparable to the tens of millions an actor might get a
No,
leading no?
it's in, and you put your finger on another very important point. I mean, once salaries start to inflate, which is, you know, around the time of Chinatown, just after Chinatown, everything inflates. And now just, you know, the cost of making a movie has become so expensive at that point, that you become risk averse.
Right. And why, I guess my question would be, if you're a corporation, ideally you would want to cut costs. Why not just, there's the constant story of, how many actors does it take to put in a light bulb? One to put it in and another to say, I could have done that. And a lot of the times it's true. There are other actors out there who could have done, what another actor could have done. Why not just hire some unknown person, pay them a little amount, and get a good movie out?
I mean, yes, great question. Well, because actors, in a way, are insurance. They're posters for your movie. They're ways to protect, again, this is risk averse, even though they cost millions and millions of dollars, that buys you not just the talent of the actor, but a way to sell the movie to the audience. Mm. Oh, we want to see Tom Cruise. That's more important than almost anything else. That becomes a selling point of the movie. So that is Hollywood thinking. It's not foolproof, of course. It doesn't always work. And that makes the business interesting and chaotic. But there was the thinking for a long time that the way to ensure a movie is to get an actor. And now, you know, movies can get green lit if an actor is interested. You know, that's sometimes all it takes to get a movie going based on that very thinking. So quality is realized, not essential that a movie be any good anymore to get made or to be a hit.
And at this time in the 70s, were they using a leading man or woman to sell movies, or how did they sell movies?
Another great question. The push to sell movies was not nearly as elaborate or expensive as it became after Jaws, which is after Chinatown. You know, the way they sold movies in this era was they would have a poster. And in the case of Chinatown, you could see it's really not selling the star or even the concept so much as it's selling a mood, something a little subtler than what you see of posters now, which is the star, the title, that's it. The poster for Chinatown's a work of art. So you have the poster, maybe a radio spot here or there, some press coverage around the time of the movie's release, and hopefully great word of mouth from a critic. Now that's not very expensive, which is nice. It keeps the cost down.
Right.
But after Jaws, really after a movie called Billy Jack, it became almost a truism in Hollywood that you could buy a success with the right amount of advertising. And I think that's proven to be true today. Almost. There are, of course, exceptions, you know. But by and large, there are guiding principles that prove to be truer more often than not.
And you mentioned Jaws. Do you think just because that was such a massive blockbuster that people saw you can really pull in massive amounts of money with, I like Jaws. I don't want to say it's a bad movie or anything like that. But how did that movie change things?
Well, yes. I mean, yes, no, we all love Jaws. Jaws is cool. But the consequences it had were not cool. Of course, that's just life, you know, that's right. Not say anything against Jaws. But let's face it, Jaws is a monster movie. I mean, Jaws is an exploitation movie. What is Jaws about really on an emotional level? I mean, you know, people could say, oh, it's a political movie because the mayor doesn't want, you know, the mayor wants them to open the beach, you know. It's not a political movie. It's not a political movie. If it were a political movie, you know, every scene would be enriched by that theme and those feelings. It's a monster movie. You're going to see Jaws for the thrills of the shark attack. You're not going because it's, you know, Chinatown, which is a political movie. Going of paranoia, man versus the system. So the fact that you could take an extraordinarily well-made monster movie and turn it into the biggest thing that ever was, with by virtue of intensive television advertising, taught Hollywood the lesson that you don't really need anything more than giant sensation and advertising. And it's been proven again. I mean, Spielberg is an extreme talent, you know, but he's an outlier in that case. Garbage hit on the level not at the level of Jaws, but it hit its own jackpot. Afterwards, and it comes back to, you know, luck and marketing. But you're not going to have luck if you don't have marketing. I think that's the major point, is that you have to buy your luck. Hollywood learned that it had to buy its luck.
Do you think that was an inevitability? Because it almost feels like, from a purely profit interested perspective, you know, business person mindset, that if you're just in it for the money, that it's what the process you're describing is almost an evolution of it's like if you're selling drugs and you're mm-hmm. just you're making a pure and pure drug, basically.
You're suggesting maybe capitalism corrupts inevitably in the end. Is that what you're saying? I mean, that's kind of what
perhaps,
you're saying. Right?
Perhaps.
I don't know. I don't know. I write books for a living, and I look at the publishing industry as relatively healthy in this respect. You know, I look at the publishing industry now the way that I think Hollywood was then, which is, of course, we want to make money. Of course, we want to be successful. But we also want this other thing called pride. And we also love literature. So I don't think it is inevitable that it necessarily goes this way. I think what happened in America also around this time was a sense of devastation and addiction. Political devastation, Vietnam devastation, really just a crushing collapse of an American, I want to say dream, I guess it is dream. And we filled it with, we filled it with garbage. We're still filling it with garbage. And it's really the beginning of an addictive American consumer. And I do believe that happened around this time. The reasons why, you know, are complicated, but the sense of the narcissistic American really flourished and around then, and narcissism is a downside of Hollywood. You don't get narcissism so much in the book business. You know, you get it in every business, but Hollywood offers so many ancillary pleasures that are wonderful when they're not abused, but to the narcissist can be, you know, a way of, and what's on screen stops mattering.
Well, here's the only counterpoint I can think to the difference between the movie industry and the book industry, which is that it's a lot harder to manipulate people. It's easier to manipulate people with images as opposed to words. I mean, most advertisement is not just a paragraph of all the things that are good about the product.
Yeah.
And so I feel like if books could do that, if there was a way to make them more crack-like, then maybe they would, but I don't know.
It's interesting. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, the film film can be passive.
Right.
You know, the movie goes on whether you are paying attention or not. And so it can hypnotize you in a way that a book really must demand that you have an active engagement in. You have to be turned on to read a book. You have to be alert and paying attention, even if the book is garbage. But in a movie, there is the danger that you can be hypnotized. And right. And that can be used for evil, you know. I don't see that, or for bad, I should say. And also, a movie looks like reality. A book doesn't look like, words don't look like reality. So it's easier to lose ourselves in the movie, which can be a numbing agent, not an enlightening agent. Sometimes it can be. I mean, at its best, it is. That's why I love movies.
Yeah, that's so interesting, because that reminds me of one of the things Andy Warhol said was when he got shot, he said it was the first time he felt like he had experienced something that was as real as a movie.
Great. Well, that's Andy being a little bit of a, it's Andy being cheeky and playful.
Sure, sure. But it touches on a similar idea, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I do want to get to these other two characters, Robert Evans and Robert Towne. Robert Evans, the producers of movies, at least artistically for me, tend to not be the most captivating characters in a project. But this guy was a real deal maker. Well, why did you feel it was important to pay this guy the amount of attention that you did in the book?
Well, because he sort of encapsulates everything that was right about Hollywood then. You know, he paid talent to do what they knew how to do best. And it really is that simple. You're not going to make a good movie without that. You're not going to make art without that. You know, you can make craft without that. You're not going to make art. And Evans wanted to make art and did make art. And he also wanted to make popular art, and he did. And that's what movies are at their best. That's why they can shape the way we think in ways most of the time books can't, because, you know, with rare exception, they don't reach the mass audience. Obviously, Harry Potter does, but
right.
That's a real anomaly. So Evans let artists be artists.
And how so? Because clearly he had some rambunctious characters working on this movie, and it seems like he didn't exactly lay down the law at any point and sort of discipline people. Or I'm just thinking of the whole Christian Bale episode where, you know, someone leaked a clip of him saying, you know, yelling at some person on the set of Terminator. Obviously we don't have they didn't have social media back then. They couldn't leak that as easily, but there were certainly disruptive events, at least on that scale, while making Chinatown. Was his role basically to just put up the money, make sure the movie happened, and step back?
Well, he liked to get involved, Evans, sometimes to the detriment of the movie. Ego got in the way of Evans. That was his Achilles heel, you know. That was never a problem with Roman or, you know, but with Evans, he wanted some sense of ownership. Ironically, he earned his ownership just by doing his job. So yes, he would get in mainly around color correcting the move, creating some problems. But Evans, of course, backed off when he realized he had overstepped. He did the same with Coppola on Godfather. That's been written about. But no, it was a happy set. with the exception of Faye Dunaway's outbursts, you know, it was a happy set.
And what about you said Robert Towne, the screenwriter. One of the things I think your book revealed it for the first time that this guy did not write alone, and that fact was sort of kept in the shadows. What was the story there?
He worked with a fellow named Edward Taylor, who he called his editor. And in the book, I really go into what that meant. I wouldn't call him an editor if Edward Taylor and I were collaborating in the same capacity on a script. But Towne called him his editor, and they worked together on many movies. Towne paid him, and they were longtime friends. And whenever we speak about the Chinatown script, we should also be talking about Edward Taylor.
And one of the things that was so strange about it was the guy, Edward Taylor, did not want any credit. And I think you mentioned his family was almost kind of weirded out about it, like this Svengali-like power that Robert Towne had over him. Well, why did he not even ask for credit?
I think Taylor liked not having the responsibility that goes with putting your name on the movie. You know, Towne, being the credited writer, is the one who goes home with all of the agony and all of the ecstasy. He'll win the Academy Award, and he will be the one who goes to bed worrying because it's his name and reputation. Taylor didn't want that responsibility. And he, you know, he always believed that because it was Robert Towne who generated the idea, that the script belonged to him.
But did he get paid?
Taylor got paid, yes.
Okay. One of the things that your book made me think of was the recent sort of kerfluffle over Scorsese's remark about all these superhero movies not being cinema. And people there was a lot of people called him snobbish for saying something like that. These movies, these blockbusters that are put out are like roller coaster rides. And, I like a roller coaster ride, but I want cinema. And he was working at this same time in the new Hollywood. What did you make when you heard him say that?
Oh, I was so glad. I was so glad. He's absolutely right. I haven't seen a reason to argument. And calling him a snob is not a counter argument. You know, that's an attack on his character.
Right.
It's not really engaging. It's not really engaging the issues that he's talking about. So, you know, we can call him a snob, curmudgeon, all those things. They're really misdirects. They're really indicative of the culture's inability to argue with him. And I, because it's an inarguable position. People also don't want to be told that what they like is shit. You know, they don't want to be told that. No one, I don't want to be told that, you know? I don't want to be told that. I totally get that. But part of education is learning to refine your taste. And if you don't look to the people who have the most experience in the field that under discussion, in this case, the movies, in this case, a guy like Martin Scorsese, who knows more about this shit than anyone on the planet, if you don't defer on some level to his expertise, which the culture is not, you're dealing with arrogance. And for people to that way, the height of arrogance, to agree with him or not. To dismiss him, the level of snobbery outright shows just how hostile and ignorant this culture is. And no wonder they like the movies that they do. They are themselves hostile and ignorant movies.
Well, but even if you look at something like Jaws, even a movie like Jaws, it feels more elevated than a lot of the blockbusters that come out today. Do you think that it's sort of a self-reinforcing cycle that when you pump out candy to people, it just people expectations go lower and lower and lower, and pretty soon scripts get are a second thought, and it's all about the spectacle.
Yes, yes. If you are fed a diet of candy, all you will know will be candy. But that's part of what education is. You need someone to say to you, "Hey, did you try this restaurant? It doesn't taste like it doesn't taste like chocolate. It actually tastes like sushi. It's a different thing. And this is why I think it's better. This is why I think it's healthier for you. This is why I think you'll feel better after." And you don't say to that person, "Oh, you're being a snob." You say, "Oh, all right. Well, I'll make a reservation. Let me try that." But while that used to be that artistic sushi, just to run with a stupid analogy. To be available on a wider scale, it no longer is. So how do people go out and find that in the movie theaters? They don't.
Well, that's the movie theater component of it is interesting, and this sort of as we're winding down here, I wanted to ask you about what you think of the streaming services. Obviously, Scorsese took The Irishman to Netflix, and it seems like places like Netflix or Hulu or Amazon Prime, whatever, are investing, $10 million, $20 million in, nice art films that are interesting and are not just blockbusters that you would go and see at a theater. And it feels like there's this dichotomy now where you go to a movie theater, this communal experience, and it's just going to be a blockbuster, and you get the art on the streaming services. Do you think there's any hope with that?
I don't see much on the streaming services. So I'm not optimistic. I mean, Irishman was a film made by a filmmaker that was then streamed. I saw it in the theater. I didn't see it on the TV, but I'm inclined to take a look just out of curiosity. But that was a movie, and I think film is I think that it depends on the intention of the filmmaker. You know, if someone makes a film, they're going to want it to be seen in a theater. If it can be enjoyed, to the fullest of its potential on TV, then it's television. Then what we're talking about is a different thing. We're talking about television. And I don't really like television. So I'm not so impressed by what I see. I don't think television really can do anything that a movie, with the exception of being longer. But it's not, rarely is longer better in the, as far as I've seen it. So I don't think art is living on.
Well, don't you think shows like Breaking Bad or The Wire where you can have almost like a novel, you can have, 20 hours of character development. Don't, I mean, at some point the length can, if it's done not just to extend the life of a show, it can add some qualitative difference, right?
And the Sopranos, I would add to that also.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely. I mean, none of these things I'm saying is absolute. I'm just speaking of trends that I see. I love the Sopranos. I stayed with it for several seasons. Wire, yeah, all these things. But you're talking about three series in 20 years, maybe, if we're going back to, I don't know, when the Wire was before, I think the 20 years,
Yeah.
that doesn't spell, and those are the examples that keep coming up, when I have this conversation, they use those exact, sometimes they'll throw in Mad Men, but there's no way that that character is a healthy art form. Four examples,
Yeah.
20 years, No way.
Fair enough. And ending on this, I suppose, Tarantino, of course, he bought a movie theater in Los Angeles, and he's big on having that communal experience. And when I went to go see Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, it was the first time I had seen like a legitimately good movie with a bunch of people all right around the time it came out. And it was a great, it was sort of an experience I hadn't had in a long time.
Yeah.
Do you see any path back to that, or is this something perhaps that's antiquated, or that we should give up on?
I think there is a path. I think it's going to be more of a gourmet experience. I think there will be movie theaters. They're not going to be as prominent. I think a big blow to the movies was just dealt with them. What is her Wonder Woman 1984, which I is going to be streamed. That's bad for movie theaters
Why do you say that?
and released in the theaters. So that's bad for. They're saying these are analogous experiences. But yeah, I think for the gourmet, I like. The people who want to go to a museum to see a painting. We can Google Picasso now and look at Guernica on our 16-inch screens. But the real hardcore will travel to go in the flesh because they know it's not an analogous experience. So yeah, I think if you live in LA, New York, and big metropolitan cities, you'll always have movie. You'll always have some version of going to the movies.
I think that's a good note to end it on. Sam, is there anything you want to plug or get off your chest before we let go?
Well, I want to plug you because you asked me some great. I love this conversation. So you're really good at what you do.
Thank
And
you.
it's fun to talk to you. And so I'm plugging Duncan.
Okay.
That sounded a little dirty, actually. I'm just saying. I'm celebrating
Yeah, we won't make those sound bite. All right.
Duncan. Thank you, Duncan. I'm here if you need anything else.
Absolutely. Yeah,
All right.
anytime. All
Thank
right.
you.
Sam, thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you to Sam Wasson, and thank you for listening to Dunk Tank. I'm Duncan Gammy. See you next time.